He says, look, if we're concerned too much about what the many say about matters of justice will corrupt our souls, so we shouldn't do that. We should listen to what the expert, if there is such an expert, would say. And the expert and the soul are not mentioned here, which is very interesting. And why is that the case? Well, my answer is that for Crito, that's not really going to be a possible source of guidance. And that instead of knowing what the soul is and its requirements, and having that kind of expertise that can produce the greatest good and the greatest evil, namely to teach wisdom, he's going to have to settle for something less. And the second best route for learning what's right and wrong are going to be the laws of the city, are going to be conventional laws. And this is why everything turns towards establishing agreements between Socrates and Crito about each step of the argument and moving towards the laws, where there's this dreamlike and beguiling speech of the laws at the end. He's really trying to beguile poor Crito, in a sense. But it's for Crito's own good, because Crito will become a better man if he can, in a sense, rise above this ethic of helping friends and harming enemies, and attain, even at this late stage in his life, a certain reverence for law as such, even when it might not be necessarily in his interest. People in the past used to give the most moral credit to somebody who did something because it was right, even if it wasn't in his interest, and especially with laws. You don't give a person moral credit for doing what's right when it's convenient. Right? Or when it's easiest, you give a person moral credit for doing what's right precisely when it's the most difficult. And yet, the ability to do what's right, or let's just say what's legal right now, because what's right and what's legal do not necessarily coincide. But let's just say that we give people respect for following the law precisely when it's not convenient, because then you realize, aha, their primary loyalty is to the law rather than to their own convenience. And a person who's like that really is what you could call a good citizen, a member of a political order. And if a person who isn't like that is not a good citizen, and the trouble is that if you have a world of people who only follow the laws when somebody's looking, then what you find is, in those many circumstances where somebody isn't, that law breaks down. The clearest example of this is the old prisoner's dilemma. Two guys who are accused of committing a crime. They don't have anything else on them, though. But they've arrested the two guys near the scene. They're pretty sure they're the crooks. They don't have any other evidence. So what do? They take them and put them in two separate interrogation rooms. And they offer them a deal. If you rat on your friend, we'll give you lenient punishment. Now, the best situation for both of them is to be able to trust the other not to rat and not to rat themselves, and then the two of them will both get off. The only way that they can get the best outcome is if they trust one another and they have a sense that they're willing to put their mutual good and take the risk of putting their mutual good before their individual interest. And if a person isn't willing to make that risk, then social order collapses. Because, put it this way, the only thing that takes individuals or little groups out of a competitive and cutthroat state of nature, if you will, or pre-political association, into political order, is being willing to take the risk of laying down one's short-term individual interests and submitting oneself to a legal order that can produce a larger good that everybody can participate in. And if you can't take the risk of doing that, then political order will either never come into existence or it will collapse. And what happens is people start, in a society where trust begins to break down, for instance, people start abdicating from the laws. They say, well, you know, I'm only going to follow the law when it's in my interest, and I'm not going to take the risk that my fellow man is going to be a decent human being if I take the risk of decency. And so what happens, all it needs is for a few well-established cases of good people being screwed or exploited. Here's a great example. Manny was telling me that some street gang decided that one of the ways they were going to induct new members is they sent them out in a car with its lights off at night, and they were supposed to shoot at the first person who flashed their lights at them to indicate that they were driving with their lights off.
Okay. Keep that in mind.
Now, keep that in mind. Keep that in mind. Now, all you need is this one case of that, and suddenly people don't take the risk of good citizenship. Russia is a society where sort of normal human trust was so crushed for more than 70 years by communism that they're really in a state of nature, and no one's willing to take the risk of following the law, because that always involves risking one's short-term benefits for long-term political stability. And so they're in a terrible situation now. No one pays their taxes. Even though the government has still enormous responsibilities, like subsidizing 95% of people's housing costs, which is absurd, but they can't collect the taxes to make the system work. So these are real important issues. And the only way you're going to have political order is if you take individuals who are self-seeking, aside from their relationships with their families, and get them to submit to common impersonal rules, even though getting them to submit themselves to those rules requires a risk that if the other parties aren't doing it at the same time, they're going to be exploited and taken advantage of. And so what you need is you need another factor that counterbalances one's calculations of one's interests. And that factor is the idea of what's noble, if you will. That a noble person, a good citizen, does their duty, does what the law states, even in cases where it's hard for them, or doesn't redound to their immediate interest. Because without that attitude, political society collapses into pre-political society. Okay? And it's very, very difficult to take pre-political societies and put them back, and put them into political order. The greatest legislators in the history of mankind have been people like Moses and Muhammad. Because what did they do? They took people who existed in a pre-political state of life, and by giving them a law and backing it up with divine sanctions, they were capable of making these people take the risk of subordinating their personal short-term interests to more universal law. With Muhammad, it took a bunch of people who were wandering around in extended families and clans and created an empire that stretched from Central Asia all the way to Spain and lasted for about 500 years before it broke down. And even today in Arabic countries, though, you find that the pre-political form of life is still very powerful. And so you find that they don't have, in Arab countries, if you're a stranger, they're willing to screw you nine ways to Sunday. There's still not an ethic of fair dealing with strangers in many of the countries we call the Arab world. That's the way that you find in any pre-political clan. Help your friends and screw the stranger. And to be able to take people who lived in that form of life and turn them into a formidable political society that created a massive empire that stretched for thousands of miles, that is a great feat of legislation. And what it requires is the creation of some form of good that people will submit to at the risk of their short-term private interests. And once people are willing to take that risk, then they find that there are larger goods available to them, political life. And political life is extremely important because it's the basis for any higher form of civilization. This is why Aristotle was so all for the polis, right? Because you can't find high culture when you've got a bunch of Sicilian clans. It's an extraordinary thing to take people out of that state and create political order. The Jews were a very stiff-necked, pre-political people. They didn't have any sort of a political order. They were nomads, right? And they were guest workers in Egypt for a very long time after that. But they never had a political society above clan structure. And after Moses, they eventually were able to found a kingdom that was quite successful for some time. The Jews went into Egypt and they became a very large people who had been ruled by the Egyptians. They had never ruled themselves before that, and they became a large enough group of people that they couldn't have pre-political order. Because pre-political order requires face-to-face interactions, which means very small groups. And so what you need is you need impersonal rules. And what he created was a system of laws that were general impersonal laws that allowed people to interact on a very large scale and found a very successful kingdom that lasted, well, finally, until the Romans, you know, destroyed it after the last revolt, first century AD. There was a long-standing political tradition. Center of 106, first of all, Socrates says, well, but you say the many are able to kill us, so why shouldn't we pay attention to that? And his basic point is, look, what's most important is not living, but living well. And living well is equivalent to living nobly and justly, which is equivalent to care of the soul, a virtuous life. And if simply living requires that you compromise on living well, then that's not worth it. You're better to die with your integrity intact than to live badly to continue living. Because life at any price is not unconditionally good. Life is only good on the condition that it's a virtuous and well-lived life. Again, the only unconditionally good thing, I believe, for Socrates and Plato is wisdom. And a life without wisdom is therefore not unconditionally good. It's only if you have virtue or practical wisdom that your life, on that condition, is really worth living. And so he's saying, if I had to give up on that, if I had to take part in my own corruption in order to maintain my physical existence, well, that's a bad bargain. That's trading gold and getting lead back in exchange. And so dying is not that important to him. Living well is more important. At the top of 107, below where it says E in the margin, Socrates says something really interesting. He says, let us consider in common, my good man. Again, he's always bringing the two together in common discussion, establishing this sort of common viewpoint. And if there is some way you can contradict my argument, contradict it and I will obey you. But if not, blessed man, then stop telling me the same argument again and again, that I ought to go away from here, although the Athenians are unwilling. For I regard it as important to act after persuading you, not while you're unwilling. Now, that's very important. Why is it important for Socrates to persuade Crito? Socrates doesn't have to persuade Crito to stay. He could say, get out of here, Crito. I don't have to justify myself to you. Why does Socrates think it's important to persuade Crito? He definitely wants to teach Crito something. He doesn't have to say a word if he wants to stay in the jail. He doesn't have to go through all this. The only person who's going to benefit from this is Crito, and he's going to try and benefit Crito. And how is he going to make Crito a better man? Yeah, exactly. Crito is somebody who needs to be, in a sense, ennobled a bit.
And great part of his prudence is to recognize that, like Euthyphro, Crito could not move into the transpolitical. He realizes that that's where they're going to be the most benefit.
Like Socrates is not under any illusions that Crito or Strepsiades could be philosophers. Put it this way, Aristophanes is not under any illusion that Strepsiades could know what's right by nature and act on it, and nor is Socrates under any illusion that Crito could do this. And so they recognize that these men will be the best they can be if they have a certain reverence for law. And what does reverence for law do? Well, it takes you outside of your more shut-up private and personal interests and allows you to make civilization possible. It allows you to make a higher order of life possible for human beings. And so a good citizen is a very good thing indeed. It has its limits, but the limits are not visible to Crito. We bump up against the limit by the bottom of 107. So Socrates says, well, didn't we agree, do we assert, at the center of 107, do we assert that in no way ought injustice to be done voluntarily? Yes. And should we not do evil voluntarily? We shouldn't do evil voluntarily either. at the bottom of 107, he says, "For surely there is no difference between human beings doing evil and doing injustice," he says. Surely there's no difference between doing evil and doing injustice. But is there? Is there a difference between doing evil and doing injustice? What's the difference? Injustice means breaking the law, right? What does doing evil mean? Yeah, going against nature. Now, doing evil and doing injustice would only be the same thing if the laws of the state are in complete harmony with the laws of nature. And that's not always the case. In fact, it's very seldom the case. And so this is a question. This is one of these live ones that Socrates throws out there, waiting for someone to say, wait a second here, wait a second. But Crito says, what you say is true, there's no difference. Well, there is a difference, but for Crito, there's no difference, because Crito doesn't see anything above the conventional law. But Socrates does, and the clearest indication of that is, remember when Socrates says in the Apology, what if you were to offer me following deal? We'll let you live, you just don't do philosophy. And what's he say? No way. No way. But the enactments of the courts were the laws. He would not obey a law against philosophizing, because philosophy is required by what's right by nature. And no human law can contravene that he will have any respect for. So Socrates believes in civil disobedience. Socrates believes in breaking the laws if the laws of the state contradict the laws of nature. However, Crito doesn't have access to that higher standard. Okay, and so he doesn't see any difference between evil and law-breaking, between what's legal and what's moral. And that's the limitation of the good citizen. The good citizen, by identifying what's legal with what's moral, can sometimes very piously and zealously do evil things because they're duly enacted by the state. Martin Luther King, in his letter from a Birmingham jail, appeals to the Euthyphro Apology and the Crito in various places. And the point that he makes about civil disobedience, it basically appeals to a notion of natural law. Civil disobedience is perfectly justified if the laws of the state contradict the laws of nature. It's right by nature. And that's exactly the Socratic position. So we know that Socrates doesn't buy the position about law that he's just handed to Crito. We have to keep that in mind. And this is especially important to keep in mind when we read the speech that follows from the laws, where they talk about education and so forth. And so let's turn to the speech itself on page 108. Near the bottom, Socrates begins the speech of the laws. And again, it's cast in the language of a dreamlike apparition. And of course it's dreamlike, because these are the kinds of flickering shadows that one sees down in the caves, these beguiling shadows. And Socrates is using these to beguile Crito. Why? To make him a better man. What if the laws and the community of this city should come and stand before us who are about to run away, or whatever name we should give it, from here and ask, "Tell me, Socrates, what do you have in mind to do? By this deed that you are attempting, what do you think you're doing, if not destroying us laws and the whole city as far as it lies in you? Or does it seem possible to you for a city to continue to exist and not to be overturned, in which the judgments that are reached have no strength, but are rendered ineffective and are corrupted by private men?" And the private man is the pre-political man. And there's a good question. How can political order exist if the judgments of the laws are overturned by private men? And this is the anti-civil disobedience argument. If everybody just says, well, I'm going to opt out of obeying the law because of my conscience, we'll have chaos. And there's truth to that, too. This is why it's a delicate issue. I would rather live in Stalin's Russia than in a state of anarchy, because bad laws are better than no laws at all on the average. That's an important issue. And the laws are raising a valid question. And then Socrates says, "What shall we say, Crito, to these and other such things? For someone, especially an orator, would have many things to say on behalf of this law if it were destroyed, the law that orders that the judgments reached in trials be authoritative, Or shall we tell them, the city was doing us injustice and did not pass judgment correctly? Shall we say this or what? Yes, this by Zeus, Socrates. Then what if the law should say, Socrates, has it been agreed to by us and by you to do this or to abide by whatever judgments the city reaches in trial? And so he's saying, Socrates, you've agreed to abide by our judgments. You've signed on the dotted line, and there's this sort of social contract view that's set out. But it's very important to ask the question, on what grounds does Crito so readily agree that we should say to the city that it's doing injustice? Isn't it an appeal to natural law over and above the enactments of convention? Or is it an appeal to some other kind of notion of right and wrong? The city's doing injustice by harming my friend. That's why he's so ready to agree to this. And what Socrates wants him to do is give up that attitude. Socrates says, but I've made a convention with the city, a compact to abide by the laws. And he goes on to explain it later. This is a kind of tacit agreement that he had every right to leave the city once he was an adult, but he chose not to, and therefore, by tacit consent, he's consented to obey all the judgments of the laws. But before he goes into that, he gives a completely different ground for the authority of the laws, and that's this. The laws say, did we bring you into existence? Your mother and father begat you, but you weren't a bastard. They weren't farm animals. They were a man and wife, legally wed, and you were their offspring, their legitimate offspring, by what? By us, the laws. The difference between farm animals and the way they breed and the way humans breed is that human beings breed under law. And therefore we have legal marriages and legal offspring. And so the laws say, we are the third begetter of you, Socrates. We're just as much your parent as your parents were. We brought you into this world, and we can take you out, too. And he says, and didn't we nurture and educate you? Center of that page, 109. What about those that concern the nurture and education in which you too were educated of the one born? Or didn't those laws among us, which have been ordered for this end, order your father nobly when they passed along the command to him to educate you in music and gymnastic? Now, music and gymnastic really are education for the body, first of all, gymnastic, and also music educates the sentiments, if you will, in what you could call the spirited part. But there's no mention of any education of any higher part of the soul that the laws provide for. And the laws don't provide for the education or cultivation of reason. If you look at the educational regime in the Republic, however, the city and speech, the musical and gymnastic education has beyond it the cultivation of reason, which ultimately culminates in the production of philosopher kings. And the city makes no provision, the laws of Athens makes no provision for that. And so in a sense the laws are indicating that they make possible a certain kind of political excellence, but not the highest forms of human excellence. Those are, in a sense, trans-political. That would be the full cultivation of rationality. And because they don't make possible this, in a sense there are grounds for breaking the laws, not because you're beneath them, but because you're above them. And this is an important factor. And then at the bottom of 109, there's a large passage there, about a third of the way from the bottom, where there are all kinds of echoes of the just and the unjust speech and of the clouds. And the laws say, well then, since you were born and nurtured and educated too, could you say first that you are not ours, both our offspring and slave, you yourself as well as your forebearers? And if this is so, do you suppose that justice is equal for you and for us? Remember the unjust speech, and remember Pheidippides. Pheidippides, who listens to the unjust speech, thinks that justice is equal between fathers and sons. He doesn't see that there's an inequality between fathers and their children, and between ancient laws and the modern demos, because he says also about the laws of a city, well, men made those, so why can't I make new ones? That's the teaching of the sophists, of the unjust speech, that justice is equal, that there are no unequal relationships, that the laws who represent a just speech that's even more powerful than the weak and flimsy just speech in the clouds, says, do you suppose that there's equality between us? Think again. And do you suppose that it is just for you to do in return whatever we attempt to do to you? Now, with regard to your father, or a master, if you happen to have one, justice was not equal for you, so that you didn't also do in return whatever you suffered. You didn't contradict him when he spoke badly of you, nor did you beat him in return when you were beaten, or do any other such thing. So is it then permitted to you to do with regard to the fatherland and the laws, so that if we, believing it to be just, attempt to destroy you, then you too, to the extent that you can, will attempt to destroy us laws and the fatherland in return. We can destroy you, but you have no right to destroy us. That's what they're saying. Justice is not equal between us. Okay? Now, most people would think, hear this and say, the fatherland. You hear all this talk and you start thinking, this is awful. But what he's trying to do is he's trying to instill an entirely proper and salutary reverence for the laws. Okay? And that reverence requires that you be willing to say, well, gee, the laws have a merit and a weight over and above my personal interests. And so I go to them not on equal terms for a self-interested exchange, but there are certain things that a citizen owes that might not be in his interest. And that's what nobility requires. And that's the whole notion of what nobility, really.
Is the political association a necessary antecedent to the transpolitical?
I think so. The laws say, Socrates, you obviously loved Athens, and you loved us enough you never wanted to leave it. Well, there are other explanations for why Socrates didn't leave Athens than because he loved the laws so much. In fact, the laws in Athens were in chaos, and he thought the laws of Crete and Sparta were better, but he didn't go to Crete or Sparta. Why? Well, because Crete or Sparta, although they had excellent laws and produced excellent citizens, did not have the conditions of freedom or the flourishing culture that Athens had. And that kind of freedom and that kind of high culture is one of the primary conditions for the creation of philosophy. And it's precisely because Athens was so decadent in some ways and had so badly governed that there was an atmosphere conducive to philosophizing. And from a very long time, people have recognized that philosophy flourishes best in slightly seedy and decadent climates. Yeah. Because as soon as you understand what's good about a particular society philosophically, that's because it's already basically dead. Yes. This is Hegel's metaphor, the owl of Minerva only takes flight at dusk, meaning that wisdom, represented by the owl of Minerva, only happens at the twilight of a civilization, when it's it's a little too ripe. Of course, decadent societies can last for hundreds of years. But let's listen to these laws, and I should have brought in some Wagner or something to play in the background. Okay, so again, and will you, that's the top of 110, and will you say that in doing this you are acting justly, you who in truth care for virtue? Or are you so wise that you have been unaware that fatherland is something more honorable than mother and father, and all the other forebearers, and more venerable and more holy and more highly esteemed among gods and among human beings who are intelligent, and that you must revere and give way to and fawn upon a fatherland more than a father when it is angry with you, and either persuade it to do whatever it bids, or keep quiet and suffer if it orders you to suffer anything, whether to be beaten or to be bound, or that if it leads you into war to be wounded or killed, this must be done, and that this is just, and that you are not to give way or retreat or leave your station, and that in war and in court and everywhere you must do whatever the city and the fatherland bid, or else persuade it what the just is by nature. And that's the first gleam of inkling of the only real gleam of the transpolitical dimension here. And the laws are recognizing that the only way to get above them is to appeal to what's just by nature. But of course, Socrates is fully aware of how impossible the task that the law set is. You know, how could he persuade the people in the court that the life of philosophy is a life just by nature? We saw what he had to do. We saw him in there with his careful Clinton-esque irony, with his careful perjury that he engaged in, and with this extravagant and false tale about how philosophy is dear to the god Apollo. That's what he had to say. There's no way of communicating to the Strepsiades and the Critos of the world what's just by nature. And that's the rub. And this is why philosophers who have a recognition of the nature of political life give up on any kind of utopian dreaming that they can completely transform the world with philosophy. And that doesn't mean that they give up entirely or that they're entirely irresponsible gadabouts, you know, just sit around and engage in mental masturbation while the world goes to rack and ruin. But there's a recognition that a political order, especially a direct democracy, is not the kind of place where philosophy can provide any kind of moderating influence. And if you want to get an image of a society in which philosophy can play a positive role, you have to look at what the sort of whole drama of the Republic. Because in the Republic, what Socrates is doing is he's taking a young man from a well-connected family, namely Plato's family, and he's moderating him, making him wiser. Philosophy can have a very powerful effect on a society through education, specifically through educating the people who lead or who will lead, but certainly not by going out and persuading the masses. Okay, and that's exactly what Socrates spent his time doing. He educated people from the best families, the most influential families, and tried to make them better men, better citizens. And that's a very valid way in which philosophy can involve itself in politics. I wanted to bring this up at Richard Perry's talk, because he sort of said, well, you know, what do? Do you go into politics and get killed, or you just huddle by the wall while the wind blows by? Well, there's a third option, and that's the exact option that both Plato and Socrates followed, which is to try and influence politics behind the scenes. Plato was certainly concerned with that, with his whole involvement with the government of Syracuse, you know, trying to improve the system that way. And you find philosophers doing that throughout antiquity. When we start doing Plotinus, and I hope you'll all be there, Plotinus was very much connected with the several Roman emperors. He went to Mesopotamia with the emperor Gordian III for some reason, we don't know what. But he accompanied the emperor on this campaign, and when he was assassinated, he scuttled back to first Antioch and then went straight to Rome and opened his school there, where he was advisor to the most powerful people in Rome, including other people who were emperors later on. And he did toy with founding a city, which was interesting. We'll have to talk about that. What Socrates does is he basically says, look, he has no answer to the laws, he says. And he asks Crito, do you have any answer? And he says, no. And so he says, well, then we have to abide by what the laws say. They brought me into this world. They nurtured me. They educated me. And I owe them a debt that I can't repay. And there is a certain truth to that. When you think about your relationship to your parents and your society, provided that your parents aren't monsters and your society isn't so bad that you would be better off being raised by wolves. Okay. You know, and there are certain people who would probably be better off raised by wolves than by the parents they have. But even rather imperfect parents are better than wolves. And they do a lot for you, like create you, that you can't ever repay, right? And so the relationship between parent and child is never going to be on equal terms. There's always going to be a kind of indebtedness that can't be bought off and therefore has to be sort of marked with a certain amount of respect. Even when they're old fools, you have to respect them and treat them well. And that's the same with a society. A society does all kinds of things for you that are so fundamental to your early education and nurturing that a decent person has to say, well, there's just a certain amount of piety that's required of that, a certain amount of respect. And that respect, that concern, is really one of the bases for being a good child of a parent and a good citizen of a society. And there's a lot of truth to that. Socrates also gives another set of grounds, which is sort of social contract view. Look, he had every opportunity once he grew up to leave, and if he didn't take advantage of that, then that's an indication that he agrees with the laws. Doesn't really follow, but he says he has no answer, and Crito can't think of any answer to that either. And so he says, well, Crito, I'm persuaded. I'm beguiled by this, and so I'm going to stay. Now, we know, though, that Socrates does not have this view of law. And why, then, did he stay? I mean, that's an important question. Well, he was an old man. Even if he did leave, it would be a life of an old man in exile in a hostile world. I mean, that wouldn't be a very enviable fate. it's certainly not a good fate for somebody who believes that life at any price is not really desirable. And so I think that he regarded staying as the noblest thing to do, not because the laws, of the conventional laws of the city said it, because of a higher appeal.